I can kind of understand that, I guess.
Guy, did you do your test with an English accent or your own accent?
Oh, no, with an American accent.
How long did it take you to develop one? Because I looked at the film, didn't realize it was you. And I said, that's the guy from Priscilla. Couldn't believe it. I thought you were so American.
Thanks. I don't know. I guess as long as it... I mean, you know, I grew up watching American movies and TV and stuff, so it feels like it comes relatively natural in a way, as much as hearing a song and being able to sing the song back.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What was Exley's problem? What did he, you know, what kind of a backstory did you give him? What did you...
Well, ultimately...
father-son thing?
Yeah, I mean, here is a guy who he's incredibly repressed in many ways, and he's living his life based on a lot of fear without realizing it, as I'm sure a lot of people do, you know.
Mm.
And so his survival technique is his intelligence and his ability to feel superior to everyone around him, and you know, he calls Bud White a mindless thug. And it's an incredibly judgmental thing to say and to think. And I wanted an audience to be judgmental of Exley in the beginning of the film, the way that we see people and say, isn't he nasty, or isn't she a pain in the ass, or whatever, you know. So I really wanted him to be someone that the audience hated in the beginning of the film because he is so dishonest or unaware of what drives him. And until consequently he does see what he is about and what his fear is, and mm-hmm. You know, and he is able to take the glasses off. Yeah.
How important is this film to you?
Very, very important. It's important in a number of ways. It's so much more important to me in a much different way than to what everyone else thinks it should be important. You know, everyone's saying, wow, this is your first big American movie, you're going to turn into this, and you're going to get this and this and this, and that's what seems to be important to everyone else. What's important to me is being able, like any film, is being able to portray a character and have an audience understand a person, I think. And I feel that is really important because I was given the opportunity and I was given a great piece of literature to work with and given a great director who really understood the person and so was given the opportunity to play out this little journey, this little journey that he goes on. And hopefully it's successful. Hopefully people do understand him.
Well, you talk about a journey. I don't know how you guys feel about talking about the ending. I'd love to. I don't want to tread on anybody's toes. But there's so many ironies in that ending. And wonder if you could talk about it a little bit so that we could deal with it maybe without revealing too much. But is it upbeat? Is it downbeat? I mean, it seems to be everything.
It's so ambiguous to me, the ending. I mean, it's, you know, I mean, there's a line that I have to Kim, which is, it seems to be a throwaway, which is, you know, they're using me for a while, so I'm going to use them. And I think that I had a bit of a problem with the ending, in a way, because I felt like it should have been really rounded off and it should have been really sort of decided. But I think the beauty of it is that Exley's actually able to be honest about the position that he's in and say, well, they're using me for a while and so I'm going to use them, until he decides what it is he wants to do. And you know, I don't think that Exley necessarily is really standing on sort of the perfect moral high ground in that, you know, by any means. And the, you know, this gets back to what I think was the important thing to try and get across in this film, to try and be honourable about, was the greyness that Elroy is so focused on. You know, that the good and evil tends to sort of just sort of, you know, do this the whole time, and that there is an ambiguity to it. So yes, you sort of left. Well, I don't know exactly how I left. It's difficult for me to say, yeah, because I'm in it. So it's, you know, it's hard for me to be completely objective.
James Cromwell character, I think, survives in the book. I don't know that he's killed.
Yes, correct. Because Exley goes after him. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's, you know, my father also in the book is not dead. So there's a lot of changes. It's difficult for me now to remember the book. Curtis sent us the book early on, saying, "I want you guys to read the book. I want us to be able to really draw from the same pool and, you know, really have an understanding of what, you know, what we're doing here." So I read the book, and, you know, after I'd read the script, and thought, "Oh, okay, there's a lot of differences." And so I brought these up in rehearsals, and then Curtis started to say, "Forget about the book. Forget the book. You know, let's not talk about the book." I was going, "You're the one that made me read the book. What do you want about?" But it was really the sensibility of the book that was the important thing, you know. And they had a fairly difficult task, you know, sort of condensing this book down into a film.
You looked at training films, certain training films to do your part here.
We looked at a couple of police training films just to try and get an idea of the, I guess, the sensibility of cops in those days. I mean, we spent a bit of time with some LAPD. Russell and I did, driving around with these guys, and they just weren't the same people that were in this film. You know, there was a real self-aware kind of modern-day cowboy attitude that I guess, you know, we've seen on the TV quite
with the real cops.
Yeah, with the real cops, and I couldn't relate it to the character that I was playing at all. You know, I just couldn't. It didn't make any sense to me. I wasn't getting anything from these guys. And so, yeah, the training films were quite beneficial. There was a stiffness about sort of a regimented kind of perspective, I think, that one sort of picked up on by looking at these films, you know.
Well,
there was nothing loose about them.
They are indeed more regimented. Paperwork, Miranda rights, I mean, restrictions,
yeah,
on what they,
yeah,
can do. I mean, what a contrast.
Yes, completely.
And that's what I wanted to get at. Initially, at least, you represent an attitude or a philosophy of law enforcement that the LAPD, at least, publicly
professes,
yeah, and you know, everybody wants to think is the best way, but the movie seems to be presenting a strong case for the heck with that. To get justice, you have to almost be a vigilante of sorts.
Yeah, well, I talked to Elroy about that.
It's kind of unsettling when you think about it. I haven't heard it brought up.
We've heard.
Well, yes, it is unsettling, and I think that's in a sense the reality of it. You know, that's
and the fact that your character comes around to that position, seemingly.
Yeah, I mean, Exley's got a lot of, you know, he becomes very self-aware halfway through the film and realizes, it's like he wakes up and goes, "Fuck, it's where I am." And this is what's happening. Shit, I'm not really who I thought I was. Gets to the end of the film and says, and is almost like in a spin, you know. It's like, well, I'm I've just got to survive this little situation here and reassess it. And I've learnt to actually like the fact that it's not so cleanly, you know, sorted out at the end, that there is an ambiguity to it, because people's lives are like that. You know, We go through something and then we come out the other end and go, okay, great, that's the end of that, and now I need to reassess that, and my life still has to go on. I have to work out how I can utilize what I've learned in the next sort of steps of my life, I suppose.
The theory has been advanced enough times, certainly even by Elroy and in books like John Douglas, in that a good, let's say a hunter for a serial killer has to think like one, so that a good cop, a really good cop, has to in some way have the instincts of a criminal in order to think what he'll do next.
Well, yeah, it's the fight fire with fire thing. Yeah. I mean, and it's where you take that, you know. It's whether or not you fight fire by thinking about fire, or whether you fight fire by dumping fire onto it. You know, it's where you feel you draw the line, and morally what your position is, I suppose. And so this is this whole movie is, in a sense, is a question about moral dilemma.
I think everyone's found himself or herself in a... Have you ever found yourself in a bad place with a cop, like a ticket or anything that...
Oh, yeah.
How'd you get out? Did you get out of it, or...?
It's just the most humbling thing. I just go,
yeah.
You know, I'm so intimidated by
you want to say
authority.
One, you don't.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I, And then for months afterwards, you think to yourself, why didn't I say this? And I'm, next time I'm going to say, hang on a fucking second, mate. You know, you're doing the, you know, da-da-da-da-da, but you never do. You kind of go, oh, look, I'm really sorry. Oh, I don't know how this happened. I'm sorry. Yeah, shit,
right,
you know, it's like being told off by the headmaster, you know. I had a school teacher for a mother, and so maybe that's where it comes from.
On your ride along with the LAPD, did you, I don't know how much of it you did, but did you get any sense of this lingering kind of, you know, racism or volatility?
Oh, totally, yeah, completely. I mean,
I would thought they'd give you guys the PR people maybe to ride with.
They gave us some PR people to ride with, but then we met with a couple of cops. Well, the PR people are ex-cops anyway, you know, and this one particular guy, whose name I don't remember and probably shouldn't tell you anyway, but... He very much had there was an attitude there that was, he reluctantly had to sort of say, well, you know, this was it's obviously the Rodney King thing and the riots and this, that and the other, talked about that, and, you know, he tried to keep it all under wraps how he really felt, and it was so obvious to me how he really felt, and then finally he sort of, you know, every now and then under his breath he'd say, well, you know, fucking black people, you know. Mm-hmm. You go, yeah, okay, I can really see where you're coming from, you know, why are you, and it makes me just go, why are you in this position, why are you doing this job, you know, and the position of power, to put a badge on and go, okay, this is now who I am, I find a really amazing kind of, an amazing sort of thing to do, you know, and they really believe that power that they have, and that's, I mean, in a sense, that's Exley too, because he, you know, to not understand yourself totally, but think that you do, and to feel you've got the right to put yourself in power like that, you know, I think you've got a long way to go as far as personal growth.
That's,
you know,
the way it's seen, is that women doing bad things in the name of authority.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But Elroy uses that language, and he imbues his character with the same language as if it were a part of them. You know, part of them.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's their... their vocabulary. Did you have much discussion with him about your character?
I did. Yeah. I mean, not a great deal of discussion. What I sort of understood about the character, I just totally picked up from reading the book. You know. And I felt like I should ask him questions, and I sort of asked him some questions, and he kind of gave me these answers that I knew anyway. You know, and he knew that I sort of knew, and so there was a sense of redundancy about. Talking to him, I mean, reading the book I really understood what he was trying to sort of portray, I think, you know, where he was coming from with the characters. Mm-hmm. It's the artistic expression that's there in the book.
So you didn't spend a lot of time with him?
Not a lot of time, no. I met him early. It was funny because I got cast in the film in like January or something, and then I flew home and got my stuff together and ready to come back, and he happened to be out there doing a book launch for his latest book, and I didn't know who Elroy was, you know. And so Village Roadshow, the sort of sister company to Warner Brothers in Australia, said, great, you've got this part in this movie, Elroy's out, let's throw you together and do this publicity thing, you know. So they threw us together, and we kind of went, well, great, what do we talk about? You know what I mean? It was too early for me to even have any questions, you know. So I sort of, but I had a breakfast with him and talked to him, and it wasn't until, you know, towards the end of the making of the film that he sort of reappeared again in my life, and I didn't feel that I needed to really get into his head. Well, like I say, it was...
scary place to be anyway.
Yeah, great place to be though. I mean, what incredible sort of sense of humour and sense of perspective.
Do you have any sympathy at all for the cop you were talking about before, and understand how he came into his worldview?
Oh yeah, I mean, I guess I have to. You know, my early instinct is to be judgmental, as, you know, when you see someone who's being judgmental, the thing that we all do is be judgmental of them. You know, we tend not to be too forgiving. But like I say, I thought, oh, okay. And then I thought, why is he in this? Why does he want to do this? And then I started to think, where's he going to go from here? Is he ever going to sort of question what he does? Or is he just going to live on this, you know, with this fucking attitude, you know, that is so... narrow-minded or racist, you know, and then it kind of went. I couldn't really dwell on it too much. But yeah, I feel for anyone who can't see, you know, something.
Is there such a racial dimension in Australian society? I mean, I know you have Aboriginal people there, but is there that?
There is in different parts. Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not as prevalent as it is here. But I think that's big. It seems so much more isolated. You know, I mean, you very rarely see a Koori, which is the sort of traditional name for an Aboriginal, in Melbourne. You know, you may see a few in Sydney. You may see a few in Adelaide. But it's when you get up to Queensland, you know, it's when you get up north, that's when you kind of see it. And I don't live up there, so I don't see a lot of that. But, you know, you certainly hear, you know, stories on the news of, particularly in, you know, in the local prisons around the northern Queensland parts, you know, and with the prison wardens and you know, the black prisoners, there's a lot of trouble that goes on, yeah.
Where do you live?
I live in Melbourne. I live way down south.
You make a movie.
Very much so. It was.
Real, I mean, as opposed to, you know,
yeah, as opposed to fake people. Yeah, yeah. No, they were. They knew there was a film crew in town. You know, you can't.
What kind of a feeling goes through you when you're dressed like that? You know, you're acting, but yet you are dressed up like that, and people are looking at.
Well, it was wonderful because the characters were so self-conscious at that point. You know, was so aware of the fact that these people were looking at them, and so to have people looking at us like we were a circus. And like I say, they knew we were in town. They knew there was a film crew in town. You can't go to a small town without,
sure.
You know, without the circus being noticed. But they didn't know what the movie was, and so the bewilderment that was there was quite astounding. It was fun, you know. It was a lot of fun. It didn't sort of seem scary at all because it wasn't just the three of us. Obviously, there were 70 crew members around us at the same time, so we felt relatively protected, you know.
Why did that movie? What was it about that movie that you think struck a chord with
people?
Do you know?
I think, you know, Stephen Elliott, who wrote the film and directed the film, do you know Stephen at all? Have you met Stephen? I mean, he's an incredible character and very loud and very brash and very nasty if he wants to be and very camp if he wants to, you know. And and in that brashness is a desperate kind of soul that is wanting to get out there and have people understand a particular element of society, and that got through in the film, I think. And you know, the music, I mean, I remember when I sat down with Stefan in the first reading and through the script he would say, okay, and this is where this song's going to be, and he would play the song, and I just got it, you know. I totally got what he was. It was such a perfect emotional kind of, not manipulation, that seems like a negative word, but I guess in a sense it was, and I just got where he was coming from, and I think a lot of the audience did the same thing. I mean, it's, you know, people say, oh, it's a feel-good movie, and I guess in many ways it is. I mean, I remember sitting on a plane with Terence Stamp coming back from Sydney. We'd just done some screening up there, and people were going burlesque over the film, and you know, it's not until you sort of see the reaction of the film afterwards that you can really put the whole thing together and understand what it all really means. And he was saying what an important film this is, and I was saying, yeah, it seemed the reaction is just incredible. And trying to understand why it had that reaction took quite a while, but I think it is the honesty of it, you know. It certainly wasn't glamorized at all. And there was a film that was made in the States that ripped us off blind.
Oh, yeah.
It's funny because they buggered it up.
Yeah.
You know?
A lot of people concurred.
Yeah, they buggered it up because they it wasn't honest, you know. They were all hiding behind something. And
the story's true that Stamp was really uncomfortable though doing it, or have I heard the wrong?
Well, yeah, he wasn't. I'm sure it wasn't the most comfortable job he's
ever
done.
That made it so funny though. You can see how uncomfortable.
Yeah.
He looked like a.
Yeah, I think early on he felt really uncomfortable about it, and he just knew that he was throwing himself completely into the deep end, and I mean in a few ways we were all sort of uncomfortable about it, but we were all pretty honest about that, and that inspired us all to sort of keep going. And so, you know, he's a very awe-inspiring man, and I think he needed us as much as we needed him.
Kirk Hansen didn't see you, as we're told, and didn't see Brazil
No.
Right?
Yeah,
you
no.
You think it would have hurt your chances for X-League?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think not. I'd like to, you know, and I'm sure with Curtis that that it probably wouldn't have hurt the chances. Because I have a lot of faith in Curtis. There's a lot of directors who, you know, you'll go and do an audition for someone and you leave the audition and you get the call later and they say, look, you know, we're really sorry, but, you know, you're just not right, your hair's too long, or something ridiculous like that. And you think, how narrow-minded can this person be, you know? And you don't know whether they're just saying that as an excuse or what they're doing. But I think in Curtis's case, and he didn't want to see the film, so maybe, you know, there is some sort of validity in that. But I think Curtis has enough nous to know that, you know, what he got out of, say, our audition, for example. You know.
Do you think the film has sort of taken in Australia anyways, typecast you in certain kind of roles? Or
no. No, I don't think so. I mean, I've never been offered another drag queen role after that. And the thing in Australia, I've been seen in quite a lot of things for the last sort of 10 years, and so. You know, and they're all a tad more butch or something than Priscilla. You know, so no, I don't think so.
What are you looking at now? What's coming in after?
Nothing at this stage. Just reading lots of things and trying to decide. It's an unusual position to be in now because you know, you always feel like you need to take a step up from the last thing you've done, or at least a step sideways as opposed to a step backwards or whatever. And this is a film that we're all so incredibly proud of, and I feel like I'm so much more proud of it than anyone else because, you know, I haven't had the experience that everyone else has had. So, you know, it is a difficult position to be in, but at the same time, it's a great position to be in because it really does force you to really go after what you think is important, you know, and not. It really makes you see. The part of yourself that perhaps goes for something because of the money element or because of the sort of the gratifying elements or whatever, you know. So it's totally forcing me to look at what I really believe in, I suppose. And I don't even know that I know what that is yet, you know, as far as the storytelling and movie-making business goes.
So there's nothing that was made concurrently or prior to this that may be coming out
soon? No. I was doing a TV series at home and took time off that to come and do this. So that was really the most recent thing.
How is this being received in Australia? I mean, it's premature.
It hasn't shown, but the film distribution company has hold of it, and we had a small screening for... I had a small screening for a bunch of friends at home, and it was quite funny, actually, because they, you know, I said, oh, I've done this film in the States, and you know, we're having a screening, will you come and see it? And I said, yeah, okay, you know, that'd be great, you know. And they saw the film and sort of got to the end of it and went... That's a really fucking good film, and we thought that if you blinked, we were going to miss you. Jesus, you know. So the response from that sort of small group of friends that I took to this screening has been great, and I'm sure it will be relatively well received.
We're about to interview Kim Basinger. Can you tell us something about her, because she's kind of an enigma as that goes. You had scenes with her.
I did, and she's just the most wonderful person. You know, the most delicate. Kind of spirit, you know, and gentle soul, and so I warmed to her so easily, and certainly not because of how she looks, you know. She's an extraordinarily incredible looking woman as well, but I feel like I'm sort of surprised or something, you know. You tend to sort of think in a judgmental way, I suppose, that when someone looks like that, they're not going to be a beautiful person, but. She's obviously dealt with a lot of pressures, and I feel for her in a lot of ways, and just a wonderful spirit.
Does the scene with Stampinato and Lana Turner always bring down the house?
Yeah, it does. It does. I'm so glad that scene worked. You know, it was one that I vaguely remember at times, sort of feeling like, oh, you know, this is hard work, or this is kind of. This is a difficult moment, but Kevin, we all know how wonderful Kevin is, and his comic timing is incredible. So yes, it gets a great response.
Is it physically grueling doing the movie?
No, not really. I mean, it was a long shoot. You know, we shot for 88 days, but I've done long running TV before, so and I know it's a totally different thing, and I don't want to throw the two things in the same category by any means, but. But
being thrown around the set stuff didn't bother you?
No, I guess in many ways I don't have much courage, you know, in it's like public speaking and areas like that, you know. So when it comes to doing crazy physical things, I'm pretty happy to do them. That's my way of making up for it.
How about that scene where you and Russell have that huge fight? You just talk about the staging of it and you didn't sustain any injuries really.
No, it was fine. I mean, this TV series that I've done in Australia is a very physical show. It's the Man from Snowy River, and it's, you know, we're on horseback, and it's set in the early part of the century, and so we're doing physical stuff all the time, you know, and quite full on, jumping off horses and cracking whips and shooting, you know, crazy stuff. And I'm a fairly agile kind of person, and so I felt very much very safe in the hands of Russell. You know, he's a very strong guy. I can't remember now, but I think it was perhaps only 1 or 2 days at the most. You know, and we, you know, Russell and I, you know, we work really well together timing wise, and we kind of got a great dance down, you know, and so it was a breeze.
When was this actually shot in Los Angeles?
From May of 96 through till September of 96. Oh, when or where?
Through September of 96.
Yeah.
Then before the Simpson trial came, that was October of 96.
Yeah.
Well, during the trial, though.
Yeah, during the trial. Mm-hmm. I would come home each night, and my girlfriend, or my now wife, would tell me, you know, what was going on with the O.J. Simpson trial.
Well, we have to tell them. You're married now? Okay. There's another one bites the dust. Okay.
Yeah.
Can you tell us your name?
Kate.
Kate?
Yeah.
How long have you been married?
6 months.
And you are how old?
29. I'll be 30 in October.
And your social security number? We're going to stop right there. Well, good luck.
This is a hangover from the. I just did a job in South Australia, and I played a surfy kind of surfy dude, you know. So I had these leather things hanging off me everywhere, and I just kind of left
Looks
it on.
That's good.
Yeah.
Hey, dude.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Be that nice. That's a good compliment.
That's very sweet.